and tied the arms around her slender waist. The only visible effect of the radiation-induced mutations that Skydark had inserted into the leggy, green-eyed redhead's family tree was the prehensile ability of her long hair, which reacted to stress like a barometer. Her hair now hung in loose curls, indicating concern, but not apprehension.
Hoof smoke could be bait.
John Barrymore Dix, a.k.a. the Armorer, approached the group. Ryan and J.B. shared a bond of blood that went back many years, to their wild and woolly days with the Traitor, the legendary Deathlands entrepreneur and road warrior. J.B. rested the barrel of his well-worn Smith & Wesson M4000 12-gauge pump gun on his shoulder and tipped his sweat-stained hat back on his head.
In a place like this, with no game to shoot, nothing growing to eat, the scent trail could draw victims from a long ways off.
Doubt it, J.B. I can't remember the last time I saw any signs of stickies or canies. No bloody bones or rags. And look at this trail. Not much foot traffic.
If you say so, Ryan.
Well, trap or no trap, we've got to follow the cook smoke, or we're going to starve in this bastard forest. Triple red, everybody. Dean, middle of the file.
Right, Dad.
Ryan's son watched with undisguised envy as Doc drew a massive revolver from the front of his frock coat. The gold-engraved Lama was a Civil War relic. It fired 9 .44-caliber lead balls through a 6 1/2-inch top barrel. A second, shorter, big-bore barrel hung beneath the first, chambered for a single scattergun load of blue whistlers, odd bits of scrap metal and glass that added up to close-range mayhem. Dean left his own weapon, a 9mm Browning High Power, buckled down in its holster. He was under standing orders from his father not to draw the weapon unless they came under direct attack, and not to shoot unless he had a clear lane of fire. With Ryan in the lead, the companions headed downslope. As they descended the winding trail, the canopy became denser and the air more humid. As Ryan rounded a turn, harsh sunlight backlit the groves of oaks ahead. The one-eyed man dropped his blaster safety and pushed on, hearing activity ahead. The companions reacted as one, spacing out along the path as they continued to advance. They dropped to their bellies and crawled the last few feet to the edge of the forest. The clearing before them bordered on a sluggishly moving green river 50 yards wide. The activity was down by the water's edge. A group of 3 dozen people, men, women, and children, all with straight black hair and cinnamon bark skin, were tending thick, hand-braided ropes that stretched back from the river almost to the trees. The children were naked. The men and women wore short kilts.
Inbreeds.
Back from the river's muddy bank, nestled in the protection of the ironwood canopy, stood a ragged row of translucent yellow shacks made of tanned hide or skin that was stretched and tied over curving supports that looked like gigantic rib bones. Cooking pits lined with red-hot coals had been dug in the soft earth. Whatever food had been roasted over them earlier had already been polished off.
No blasters, just knives.
Bone knives at that.
No threat.
The breeze shifted suddenly, swirling along the bank. Cook fire odors were overpowered by a terrific stench.
Ugh, smells like dead fish. Tons of dead fish.
I just lost my appetite.
Don't trouble yourself over that, my dear doctor. If past is prologue, it will return to you shortly, and tenfold.
Is that a fat crack?
Why, of course not.
And how exactly are those tapeworms treating you today, Doc?
Why,
come on, people. Let's introduce ourselves. Stay alert. Watch the flanks.
My dear Mildred, women without your physique in my day died in childbirth. You are a...
Save it, old coot.
The companions emerged from the forest, fanning out with weapons up and ready. The river people were startled at first, but they said nothing. None of them made a move to approach or to retreat from the armed intruders. After a moment or two of standoff, the villagers pointedly turned their backs on them and refocused their attention on the murky river and their braided ropes, each of which was strong enough to tow a war wagon.
What the hell's that all about, Dad?
Hello! We're...
A man wearing a translucent fishskin vest held up a hand for silence. There was a warning in his extremely close-set black eyes. He pointed at the river, which silt and algae had turned the color of pea soup. Stretched across its width were floats made of clusters of blue plastic antifreeze jugs, tied together by their handles. The villagers had a fishing net out. Dean stepped over to the bank for a better look.
Oh!
As quick as a cat, The boy jumped back from the river's edge. Ryan swung up his 9mm blaster in a two-handed grip. Over its sights, 20 feet from shore, he saw a swirl, like water sheeting over a great boulder just under the surface. Then a 5-foot-long bone blade, like a dirty yellow two-handed broadsword, slashed up through the surface. It gleamed for an instant, then disappeared beneath the murky flow. Ryan held his fire, as did JB, who had his scattergun hip-raised and ready to roar.
Fire blast! What the hell was that?
Shades of King Arthur and the Lady of the Lake.
King who?
In this case, Excalibur appears sadly the worse for wear.
Before the companions could decipher Tanner's remarks, the strings of blue net floats jerked violently, then skittered across the water like a flock of leg-snarled waterfowl. One by one, the clusters of antifreeze jugs bubbled under the surface and stayed there, trembling in the current. Whatever it was caught fast. The villagers leapt to their ropes and pulled them taut, their bare feet sliding in the mud. Only when the creature swam up to the surface and began to thrash mid-river, rolling and wrapping itself in the fishnet, did Ryan realize how big it was. The brown-backed fish was easily 30 feet long. Its great tail slapped at the water as it momentarily turned belly up. Holy shit. Before the river beast could get its bearings, the villagers began to draw in the net. Men, women, and children hauled for all they were worth, their legs and backs straining. As they retreated from the waterline with the net in tow, they made the great fish roll over and over, further entangling itself. A gargantuan mutated catfish flopped onto its belly on the edge of the bank, showering mud in all directions. Its mouth gaped. The gigantic lips looked plump and rubbery and almost human, as did the pale tongue. Its eyes, which were set far apart on a broad, flat skull, wider than a man was tall, radiated a terrible fury. The ventral and dorsal fins were extended through the mesh, as were their cruel, serrated spines. The cruelest of all stood atop its back, like a hellship's mast. Unable to pull the fish any farther onto shore, the villagers secured the free ends of their ropes around the tree trunks at the clearing's edge. One of the men cautiously approached the animal. He walked stiffly, his head lowered, shoulders slumped, obviously very much afraid. Behind him, a pair of village women began to wail and cry and tear at their own hair.
I don't like the looks of this. Why don't they stop that guy?
Gonna be chilling.
The ropes groaned as the great fish lunged against the net. With a crack like a pistol shot, the line at its head parted in the middle, one end sailing high into the trees. Before the man standing beside the beast could retreat, it had him. Whipping its head sideways, the fish sank the point of a ventral spine into his chest. Then it rolled on top of him. With impacts that shook the ground, it flopped, using its tremendous weight to pound the man and the impaling spine into the soft mud. The screaming villagers grabbed the loose end of rope and drew it tight. Then they angled the other lines until the fish was once again in flat on its belly. Skewered on the spine was a muddy, bloody rag doll, the head lolling backward on a broken neck. Three men carefully slid the body off the bone broadsword and laid it down gently on the bank, a safe distance away. A handful of villagers, including the wailing women, knelt beside the corpse. With cupped hands, they dripped river water on the body, tenderly washing the mud and blood from the face and chest.
Phew. Ugly way to croak.
Let's make sure nobody else gets nailed by that red blasted thing.
The companions quickly formed a firing squad beside the fish's head. But before they could shoot, the man in the fishskin vest jumped in front of the raised muzzles, waving his hands.
No! No!
What?
No lead! The metal will put a curse on the meat!
You got to be shitting me!
With that, the village leader scrambled onto the fish's head, using the net's mesh for hand and footholds. He was joined by another man who carried an ironwood club and a 3-foot-long bone sword. The leader took the sword and knelt down, feeling around on the fish's forehead with his fingertips.
What's he doing?
He's looking for the seam in the skull, son. A weak spot in the bone.
The village leader found what he was searching for. He positioned the sword point against the skull, dropped his hands below the skin-wrapped grip, and nodded to the second man, who raised the club and struck the pommel of the sword a mighty blow. The serrated blade sank in a foot. The great fish didn't even seem to notice. But when the man dealt it a second blow, driving the sword in another foot, the animal went berserk. humped up, heaving its body against the net, its long, fleshy whiskers curling and cracking like bull whips. The man struck again with the club before the fish could throw them off. On the third whack, the blade slipped into the hilt, the muty catfish's